Hey there, welcome to In Full Color, a podcast on race, community, and justice. I'm Taylor McGee, your host, and today I'm chatting with three of my close friends, Allison, Blair, and Emily. We talk about what it means to be a white ally and how to mediate white privilege and white guilt when educating yourself. We also talk about the importance of voting in the 2020 election and how to use the energy from the Black Lives Matter movement to fuel the beginning of system-wide change. Hope you enjoy. I'm going to have each of you go around, and if you could please introduce yourself, and so tell me who you are, what you do, and how do you identify racially and or ethnically?
Okay. I'm Blair. I just graduated from Emory University, fake graduated in the spring. I'm currently unemployed, such as the state of the world right now. But I'm looking to get into brand strategy for advertising. And right now I'm taking about a 3-month long brand strategy bootcamp class through the Miami Ad School. And I am just quite simply white. I'm just about as white as it gets. My family's been on both sides in the US for about 100 years. So
I'm Emily. I'm also a recent graduate of Emory. Graduated in quarantine in the spring. I don't really know what my title is. I would think I'm unemployed technically. Like I'm going to start coaching field hockey at my high school, COVID permitting. And I have an online internship, which is great, but I'm kind of going through a little existential crisis at the moment. Not really sure exactly what I want to do in the future. And I'm also very, very white.
Okay. So I'm Allison. I'm from New York City, and I graduated with these two back in May. And I actually just started my first full-time job 2 days ago. I'm doing equity research at an investment bank in New York. So this is a really nice break from reality for a little bit. Just a nice break to be able to talk with my friends. But I would say also that I identify just as white as these two as well.
Okay, awesome. And so I met these three wonderful ladies in a discussion-based class in fall 2019. And my original perception of y'all was just like, oh, these are just like some three white girls and like involved in Greek life, like cool, cool, cool. And then as the semester went on and we started reading memoirs that were like more specific to like racial or like ethnic groups or just more marginalized people, how my perception like changed. And I think it's super easy to stereotype and typecast white people. And I'm guilty of that myself. And so how have y'all kind of just like dealt with or battled with being stereotyped in a certain way?
I'm sure Emily and Allison can agree with me. Like, as a white female, we have the benefit of not really being stereotyped in a lot of ways, or at least a lot of like harmful ways. Like, it was nothing I've ever really had to think about. But what I will say is, through a lot of my time in school, people just kind of assumed that I was more conservative, based on being, I'm from Idaho. My parents are pretty conservative. My like class status, and then also just a lot of my friends. And I think I also spent a lot of time not really correcting people. But especially in these recent, like, I guess 3 or 4 months, I've lost track of time. I think the only way really that I've kind of reconciled overcoming that is not being so silent about it. So even if someone says something to me expecting me, where in the past I'd be like, oh, they'd say some comment about like the Black Lives Matter movement or about like someone running for president or whatever it may be, I would kind of be like, okay, and just silently disagree in my head. And now I don't at all. I choose even just to question people. So if they're like saying like, oh, you know, I don't really think the US is as racist as people say it is, I'm like, why do you say that? And kind of like push back a little bit, which I think in a way kind of makes people reconsider this stereotype based on all these things that would be on a piece of paper about me, like my background.
Yeah, you know, I would add on to what Blair said. She hinted at this, where I haven't really had to think about it that much. Like, I'm never, like you said, how do you identify? That's not a question I have to answer that much unless I'm filling out some sort of application. You check a box and you say white. And, you know, I think over, especially with everything going on in the world right now, I've been thinking more and more about how, in order to be a better ally, in order to try and make a difference, how I identify myself, because I don't think that's a question that I ask myself a lot in my life. And I think by asking that, it kind of gives me a better viewpoint in terms of how I could possibly make change in the world. So I think that it's a question that I haven't had to think about, and I haven't been challenged with having to think about in the past. But looking forward, it's definitely something I'm looking to answer for myself more.
That reminds me of something that one of my really good friends, we've been having a lot of these conversations about. And she was saying that, like, when you're describing people or like organizations, the standard or like the normal, the regular is like a white blank. So like you'd be like, oh, that's a black restaurant in this town. He was a black man. It was a black bank. But like a white is like the, I don't know, the norm, assumption. Yeah. So like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like what Allison was saying, it's never something, yeah, nothing we had to ever consider of like, oh, I identify as like this ethnicity, because like I've like never had anyone ask me like where I'm from originally type of question that you hear a lot of people of color experience.
Yeah, for sure. And I've been reminded of how whiteness wasn't always a default of like when you look back at early 20th century and you have this huge wave of European immigrants. I mean, for such a long time, like Polish and Italian Americans were a like ethnic minority. And that was the same with the Holocaust, of when Jews and Eastern European Jews were coming to the US and fleeing Nazism, they were viewed as an ethnic minority. And so it's interesting to look at how American culture has evolved to a point of like, we lump this like notion of whiteness into one category, but when you break things down, it gets kind of complicated. And so maybe I'm not remembering this correctly, but are a couple of y'all like heritage wise Jewish or no?
I am. So I'm Jewish, and I'm also, I guess, Polish from a few generations back. So my grandparents or my great grandparents, whatever, honestly, I don't really know the details, but someone immigrated here. So I would definitely fall into that category. But again, like that wasn't even something that came to mind when you said, how to identify. I guess maybe people who feel a stronger connection to their Jewish heritage would have said Jewish, but that wasn't something for me that I would have mentioned right away.
Yeah, same with me. I'm technically Jewish, but my family takes that very lightly. So that's never really, unless someone specifically asks, like, what religion, I always say, like, technically I'm Jewish, but.
I'm the exact same way, but I also, members of my family on both sides are Italian immigrants. And so, like, I have that in my background, but I don't immediately think of it. And I do remember, in like, when I was younger, my grandma always telling me, like, I'm 75% Italian, and, like, the math not adding up for me, because, like, you have four grandparents. And I was like, 75%, like, that doesn't make any sense. But I do, when you explain it out like that, that, like, it reminds me of something that I learned through studying history at Emory, which is that there's whiteness has like what I was kind of getting at before, which is like in the more common speak, like the default that we kind of used to always go back to. But there's also otherness, which is like there have been historically a lot of like white people of different ethnic groups that are just lumped in with otherness, for some reason or other. But that the otherness is kind of what defines people rather than their race necessarily.
There was like one week amidst this like Black Lives Matter movement, of this like burst of it at least, where anti-Semitism came to the forefront. And so what a lot of people don't recognize, and I think this is why the Black community isn't always receptive to having like white and or like Jewish people get involved, is because there is such a complicated history between Jews and Black folks.
And
it's on both sides of like, you have so many Jews have been incredible allies to the Black community and had equal persecution in the early 1950s, 1960s time period of there were all of these lynchings of Jewish people in conjunction because they were like mm-hmm. involved with like African-American protesters. But then you also have like the Zionist movement and like the Black Power movement and all these kind of things are intertwined. And so there's this really interesting kind of tension. And so I think that is something a lot, my other friends who are white and Jewish have kind of like had to wrestle with because automatically there is kind of an assumption in the Black community for a lot of people of it's kind of like, okay, your opinion doesn't matter for whatever reason. And it's like, you have a choice to opt out of this conversation. And then looking at, was a huge boom in the 1980s and 1990s of biracial babies who are half Black and half Ashkenazi Jewish. And so that's like Tracy mm-hmm. Ellis Ross and a bunch of other celebrities. And so that caused a lot of like tension in both communities because of this like really long history of all of this. And so
I think I see what you're saying, Taylor. It's that as like a white person, none of us can ever, and none of us, I mean me, Emily or Allison, can ever claim to completely understand what it is like to be a Black person in America. Mm-hmm. But as understanding like the Jewish struggle or whatever it may be, if you're mixed race for referring to other people, I think especially people that are really strongly connected with their like with their Jewish heritage feel that's their way to connect. And it's like a common ground, you know, like if to be perfectly blunt, like if you're like a Christian or Catholic white upper class male, you can't, there's no part of you really that can understand mm-hmm. anything. So even as like a Jew, and I can't even say that just because my family left Europe so long ago that I don't feel super connected to it. But I think for a lot of people that are really strongly connected to their Jewish heritage, it's the closest thing they can feel to understand that, just because the Holocaust is essentially has very similar sentiments than the way that Black people are treated in America right now.
And I agree with that. I think that the problem comes a lot of the time where people try to play the whose situation is worse game. And that's not a game you can try to play. And people try playing it. And people on both sides play it. And it just kind of creates a mess in the end because they're not comparable. You can, you know, I always say to people, you can see in, when you're walking on the street or you're driving a car, like, and you are a person of color, you can't turn that off. Can you turn off your Judaism technically? Like, no, but it's different. It's a different situation because it's a different type of identification. And just like that, just that difference right there gets at the fact that you can't play that game, because once you start playing that game, it's like both situations suck. There's change for all of this going on, and you can't play that game because once you do, you're just going to go on forever because every situation is bad.
Well, it's the same argument with like Blue Lives Matter. Is some people are like, well, my husband or my wife or whoever, your friend, is this great police officer that, I don't know, that isn't racist. But at the end of the day, they can take off their uniform. You can't shed off your skin and put it next to your, in your closet and go to bed as essentially a white person. It's the same thing. I think obviously like the Holocaust was kind of built off this idea that you can tell people are Jewish from the outside. But as Allison said, especially in the United States, it is increasingly more difficult to tell if someone is Jewish or not. Like nobody would look at me and be like, oh, she has Jewish heritage. Like there's nothing to show that.
Mm-hmm. Building off of Blair's point where you can't turn off like the Blue Lives Matter. You can leave your job and then you're who you are, but you can't like leave behind your skin color. I think there's something to be said about like the way in which we all experience discrimination to a varying degree. And like, if you're comparing apples and oranges, so to speak, like of the different types of discrimination that a person can endure based on race, based on judgment being passed for a job, even though that's a completely different thing, or like for your gender, for your religion, or for any other which reason, if you start like almost like comparing them on the same playing field all the time, like, then you're never going to like connect with another person. You're always going to be at odds with other people because you're always going to be saying like, well, why can't you understand my perspective? But you're also not trying to understand someone else's perspective, if that makes sense.
It makes 100%. Yeah. Like I think about how a lot of times when you're having these discussions, someone will be like, well, what about this? But I think we need to have a big feminist movement because women are treated so unfairly. And I think that's part of what I think a lot of people took an issue with this Black Lives Matter movement in terms of like people kind of playing devil's advocate is like, nobody is going to sit here and tell you women's struggles are made up or being a Jew, their struggles are made up or you name it, whatever these struggles are. But I think you're right in Emily that it's taking away from the topic. It's no one is trying to discredit that you don't have struggles. Everyone has their own, like their own stuff to deal with, but it's that like you spending so much time being like, well, what about my struggles takes away the fact from understanding that somebody else has an experience that you might not be able to understand, but you can kind of listen and learn and start to empathize with.
With that in mind, like if you have experienced discrimination in whatever form that you believe you've experienced, sorry, I'm saying believe because like I keep thinking about like the Blue Lives Matter movement and it does kind of rub me the wrong way. But moving past that, but like if you have experienced discrimination and you recognize that, then why are you so quick to talk about that when you're seeing other people very publicly and very on a very global, not just national, but global scale, experiencing discrimination in the public eye? Why are you then fighting that and talking about yours instead of using that experience that you felt experiencing your own discrimination to help like be there and fight their battles with them because you kind of know what it feels like to be discriminated against? Like, why are people like so hostile towards the Black Lives movement, but yet so willing to talk about their own discrimination? It's like that part of it doesn't really make sense to me because it's like that should be a motivator to be a better ally, to be a part of the Black Lives Matter movement in whatever way you can, because it's like you then know what it feels like. Again, not on the same caliber and not in the same way, but you know what discrimination feels like. So shouldn't you fight against it whenever you see it?
There's two things like at play here. Is one, we literally have to teach empathy now. It's like that is no longer like a base understanding of like, you don't have to like go through the exact same thing to like resonate with someone and to like understand on some kind of level, on a human level, not even like an interpersonal level, but just like you're another human being who feels things and has emotions and like goes through shit. That is something you have to teach. And people get so defensive. And like going back to what Blair was saying about like the cop example, is like there are good people who happen to be cops, but there are not good cops because they are upholding a rigged system. And so like all these examples of like, oh, like I know this person and like they're also a cop. I'm like, okay, let's talk about the but also part of like they may be like a great dad. They may be like a whatever, a good church going man, like whatever, has black friends. You're attaching some kind of signifier to a system. It is not just like literally being a cop as a job. Like you can opt out of putting that uniform on, but you can't opt out of upholding a system that actively denies like basic human rights. And so that touches on what Emily and Allison were saying about like these intersectional issues, you know, of like the Black Lives Matter movement is attached to anti-Semitism just as much as it's attached to feminism and environmentalism and all of these issues. And so people are going to come to the table with a different understanding.
There's empathy you can have for understanding someone that's black, their struggle. But I think what's really hard for people to come to terms with is owning that they're part of the problem.
Exactly,
and I even saw this with my own experience kind of as this movement like picked up, and also especially with other people in my life, is like at the beginning of like when George Floyd passed away, was killed, I suppose you could say, there was a lot of like posts on Instagram that were like kind of like the dear white people type of messaging. And at first when I read those, I almost felt like, I don't want to say attacked because it was more like I was like, I didn't know what to do with it. And then I had to check myself because I was like, okay, let's look at my life. I went to a private school. I had SAT tests or prep, excuse me. I had college counselors. I was able to play sports. I had all these opportunities that aided me. I went to Emory University, we all did. I went to a great school. I had all these things that were given to me kind of without question.
And so how have you guys in the past couple of months been navigating this surge of like reconciling with like white guilt and like white privilege and things like mm-hmm. that?
Well, I think you can't erase your privilege. You know, I can't go back in time or I can't even go into the future and be like, I don't want people to see me as a white female. And now what I kind of see with this like white guilt is like, I can't change the way that I am perceived. I can change the way that I perceive other people and the way I speak to other people and the way that I like conduct myself. So sometimes like if I say something wrong or if I post something that isn't right or whatnot, instead of like feeling attacked if someone's like, oh, that's not right, I see it more of like, okay, I'm trying my best and I'm really here to like learn and grow and acknowledge the fact that like my life looks a certain way because of the color of my skin.
You know, the biggest thing for me, Blair, that makes so much sense, and I think at least for me, what I've been working on in the past few months and what I came to the realization of when all of this kind of blew up was that I had been taught for so many years in my upbringing to be essentially colorblind. And that's really how I was raised. And I don't think that was a bad way to be raised. Like, I'm not blaming my parents or anything for that because I was surrounded by a ton of diverse communities. There were plenty of situations in my childhood where I had so many different types of people around me, but I was raised to be colorblind. I think the difference now is what I'm at least trying to work on is kind of putting that idea on pause and instead focusing, okay, no, people are different. And what do you do to help them? And that's really the difference that I've kind of found with all of this going on, that I need to actually be an activist. Like, I can't just say I treat everyone equal and that's great. Like, that should be, like you were saying before, you have to teach empathy these days. Like, that should just be a common understanding. Like, you treat people the way you want to be treated. That's it. And you treat everyone the same. But the thing is, you need to kind of do more. And I think Emily and I actually were talking about this at the very beginning. Like, we realized we needed to be more of an activist than we have been in the past.
Right. No, I agree with both what Blair and Allison said. Because I think there is, in this current moment, like a lot, I've been experiencing a lot of white guilt, but I noticed pretty early on that like, no one wants to hear about my white guilt. My white guilt doesn't matter, but the way that I can use it to my advantage, the moment's advantage, everyone's advantage, is to use the moments in which I've like reflected on my life and noticed moments where I've been not a great ally to the Black community, but also other communities that I'm not a part of. Instead of just like festering in the guilt that I messed up then or that I mess up now as I kind of go through life, like I'm just saying, okay, what can we learn from this moment where we're feeling a little bit guilty? And how can we change that if we experience something like this going forward? How can I kind of like use that guilt that I'm kind of feeling within my own individual self to be better in a larger sense? Because I think, I mean, yes, change happens at the individual level, but I think with something this systemic and, I mean, persisting, like you look at, again, going back to the fact that I studied history, you look at the basis of America is racist. And so when you think about how long this has persisted for, this is not something that's just going to change because we all read White Fragility and said, oh my gosh, I'm going to be better tomorrow. Like,
Emily, something really important that I think you just said is that systemic change does not like occur overnight. These problems are not going to change because people's posted on social media saying they feel bad and they're listening and they posted the Black Square and that was it. And I think that was there's so much we can unpack with how all of that social media stuff unfolded, because I think there was a lot good with it and a whole lot wrong with it. But I think just in terms of change happening, people need to understand that just because they say, oh yeah, I'm no longer just colorblind, I'm now actively anti-racist, so I just changed everything. Like, yes, those little changes and those mindsets are great, But just because a company says they're going to donate 15% of their profits for the day to Black Lives Matter, like, that doesn't change. That's a good change, but it's not going to fix the world.
The be-all, end-all.
Exactly. And I think that's so important to understand. And I think that people miss that a lot. And, like, it's such an easy thing. Like, we say, okay, yeah, obviously change doesn't happen overnight. But when we talk about the idea of defunding the police and we get into that and stuff, it's like, things like that can't happen overnight. You can't just fix the world in a second. And I think that's so important to all of this that's going on is, you know, these little steps that you take, they don't automatically make you a great person, but they, by doing them, but by, you know, doing things to make yourself actively anti-racist every day, that's something that I can do over time to eventually help. You know, I think there's a difference there.
Why I wanted to sit down with you three is because throughout this time, you have been like, there's been a certain level of intentionality to like being anti-racist and to speak up even in these like white spaces that you occupy. And so I'll pose two questions and you can either like respond to one or both or as you see fit of what actions have you taken in your daily life to be anti-racist? And then two, how are you speaking up in your own community or in like predominantly white spaces to continue uplifting and amplifying Black voices in the community right now?
So for me, like I was kind of saying, like I can't sit here and claim that I'm going out there and changing the world, but I'm trying to do a lot of like self-checking myself. So whether it's like with thoughts or like beliefs that I have ingrained and I just want to question myself a little bit, but also in just like the, in my classes, we make a lot of like advertisements, weekly. And even something I've noticed is that like, I'm trying to make sure that when we're producing something that it has equal representation of people. So in the past, I might've just pulled off a picture of the internet that was a white male and it seems so, I don't know, it seems so innocent, but in reality, like that's part of what is part of the problem is that like there's not equal representation in advertising, there's not equal representation in media. So that's like one small thing that I was actually kind of proud of myself that I even like thought of, that I was like, you know what, I need to make sure there's representation. And then also, as much as like reading and whatever doesn't do much in the grand scheme of things, I think educating myself has been really important. So listening to podcasts, reading, like engaging with really interesting viewpoints. And then in terms of like taking that into the world, I think the first step for me has just kind of been my immediate family. And I have younger brothers, so trying to push them and to get them to think about racism in a different perspective. And then as well with my parents, which has definitely been a lot more difficult and has caused a lot of trauma, but it doesn't stop me. But also just being vocal in any conversation I have. So if it comes up and someone's like saying something that just doesn't sit right with me, is like, instead of just like sitting there and kind of like letting it go, I like question it and be like, I don't really agree with what you're saying, just so that maybe one of those people will question it themselves. And just hope that like enough people kind of do that, that everyone starts to question themselves. But as I said, like, I'm not here to sit here and say that I'm doing everything perfectly. But I hope that in some way that I'm like, or even just challenging people that are talking to me. Like if someone responds to my story and will be like, someone responded to something I said about like Trump banning TikTok. And this obviously doesn't really necessarily have to do about Black Lives Matter, but it was a response that said something about like, it's so the Chinese don't spy on us, gives the Chinese power. And I was like, what? And just kind of like questioning people and being like, why do you think that? Like, I don't think your belief is necessarily true, but just questioning them and being like, if you have a substantive response to this, I respect that, but also like don't just say something and be like the US isn't racist, or like maybe Black people shouldn't resist. Why are you saying that with something behind it to back it up, or are you just saying that? And just hoping that maybe people can start to question themselves and get rid of those underlying assumptions they have.
But that all makes so much sense. And I think it sounds like, I mean, I can tell from just having conversations with you and seeing what you're posting on social media and just off of those two things and this conversation right here, like clearly like the effort is there. And like, at this point, like that's really what you, all you can ask for is that people actually are trying, and like that itself does so much. And I think that for myself, I would give myself a little bit of credit in a way, just because I think I have made an active effort throughout my time at Emory. You know, I was a business major, like didn't really have to take any really many classes after I kind of filled in the gaps of like the GERs and everything that were like outside of the business school. And like, I made an active effort to do so because I thought it was important. So like, I took racial and ethnic relations just because I wanted to. I took a class focused just on Zora Neale Hurston and her writing and her stories. I took a class this past semester on citizenship and what it means to be an American. And like, these classes just really interest me because I wanted to learn more. I find that like, I learn best in a classroom setting and in a discussion setting a lot of the time. So for me, that was a great way throughout Emory to be able to learn and be able to hear other voices. Now, that doesn't make me a perfect white ally in the slightest. I think it's helped me with all of this and having a kind of educated background, some of the theory and some of the important voices in, like, in Black movements and throughout America, whatever. But I think in terms of right now, what I've been trying to do is really have conversations. And I think that, just as Blair said, challenging points of view, that has been so important for me and my learning, and realizing that, listen, not everyone agrees, but even, you know, all this has become so polarized, but even in terms of politics, but even people, you're a Democrat and I'm a Democrat, let's say, like, we still might disagree on things. And there's this assumption that like, you're either a Biden supporter or a Trump supporter, and you follow everything that they have to say. And that's not true. Like, Biden supporters will disagree on things, and that's totally fine. And that's important. And I think being able to disagree with people and having conversations is really important. And then I think the last thing I would just add in there is, I noticed, for example, the head of EPC, so Greek Life, Sorority Life at Emory, posted asking for feedback and like ways it can make the community better. So instead of just like ignoring that, I like reached out to her and we had a conversation. And like, obviously she knew there's a ton of work to be done, but it was something that we just were able to discuss. And like, I gave some opinions on like things that I think could have been done based on my experiences. So like, little things like that, okay, yeah, they're not going to change the world, but like, they can help and they're not going to hurt.
I mean, I think the thing that I've been kind of focusing on the most is what I do off of social media, because I regardless of performative allyship on social media, I have already a twisted relationship with social media, just because I have anxiety, and just kind of with Instagram especially, kind of thinking about how you appear is not necessarily how you are. So trying to like make sure on social media, anything that I do is as genuine as possible. And like, what I post is stuff that I've already read and stuff that I've donated to and stuff that like, it's coming from a genuine place. But also most of what I feel like I'm doing right now in this current moment is internal and also personal. Like what Blair was saying about checking herself. Like I've been noticing a lot of times where I've committed microaggressions, and like recognizing those and thinking to myself, okay, you might not have thought of this in any which way, but think from someone else's perspective, think from a person of color's perspective, like how is what you're doing right now going to be received or perceived, and how can you fix that? And like, then catching myself and saying like, okay, what can I do? So like, I don't genuinely believe the world revolves around me, but I also have had to make like a conscious effort of saying like, this is not my place. This is not my, this is a fight that I can fight, but it's not my fight to fight. So I shouldn't be the protagonist in this story. I shouldn't be like, this is all that I'm doing. Look at me doing all this good work. And so I think with that, I've had a lot of really great conversations with so many different people from so many different walks of my life and in spaces I've occupied, just about kind of all of these multitude of issues. And one thing that I'm trying to do better in my spaces, in my area, is kind of picking a fight that is something that you care about, that is something manageable for you to fully educate yourself on or continue to educate yourself on in a very fulfilled and what's the word for it? But like kind of pick like a niche and focus on that issue and focus on the way intersectionality fits into that issue and what you can do for that issue. And so I think like in having the more broader conversations on like race with my family and with my friends, especially my white friends, like just talking to them and trying to open everyone else's minds up the way that I'm trying to open my mind up. I've been focusing a lot on like voting rights and how voting affects people differently and how voting affects everyone. And so it's just kind of like, if I can focus on that issue and focus on where intersectionality fits into that issue, I can help lead conversations that are not necessarily like me speaking for Black people or people of color. Like that's not what I'm trying to do, but trying to speak about an issue that pertains to people outside of just like my whiteness, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So like kind of like talking more about the bigger issues and how to fight the bigger issues rather than saying like, hi, this is the issue Black people face. Listen to me talk about it, if that makes sense.
And I'm saying this as someone who has light skin privilege, but I think people forget that because of how the system has been made for centuries now in America, purely because your skin is lighter than mine or someone else's means that you have a seat at the table that other people don't. And so issues of like voting and reproductive rights and all of these other intersectional issues, it's like, okay, well, you already know that BIPOC folks, they're not even at the table. They don't have a voice. They are being silenced. And so it is, I think, white people's job to not speak for BIPOC, but to hand the microphone over and be like, hey.
I was just going to say, pass the mic. Oh, sorry.
Literally. You like, it is a matter of passing the mic. And so, especially with voting, that's something I've been thinking about too, because I think our generation, there's a mixture of like half are like really empowered to vote, and then another half are like, well, Trump won the first time, so like it doesn't really matter. And I'm sitting here like, white people, your vote will not be deleted. You will have better polling centers. You will have better access to absentee ballots. And Emily, you've gone through this and it like didn't really matter that you were white because the voting system is just like fucked up.
It's just fucked from top to bottom.
It just is. There's this moment of like, I think all of you touched on of how you're trying to check yourself and to recognize that like the guilt that you feel in a variety of situations isn't what is most important at the time. It is a matter of, okay, why do I feel this way? How do I interrupt that thought, that emotion, that reaction to have a different perspective on it, to put myself in the shoes of someone else?
I think the things that the three of us have said so far, and like something that it has been a fear of mine, that this moment is just going to be a moment where I think it dawned on me kind of early on that this is not something that you can just fix. Like we were saying before with like reading one book or doing one thing. I think something that we've all kind of recognized is how lifelong this is. And that's really inspiring to me because like, it's encouraging me that like, okay, like even though we're going to mess up, obviously, like there's no way to be an activist correctly or properly. Like, I mean, there's ways to do it correctly, but there's no way to do it perfectly. I don't know. It's just really inspiring talking to you guys. It always was in our class and stuff, but like,
oh my God, that class, we all miss it.
I always think about like, do you want to be on the wrong side of history? Like that is like my,
yeah,
right.
I can sit down and like take the easy route. It's so easy to do that. But I'm like, do I want to look back and be like, in 2020, I sat back and I just let this all happen and I did nothing? Or do I want to say to like my friends, my kids, be like, no, I checked myself and I thought about my life and I tried to change it for the better. And like, I want the latter. I you know, you don't want to look back and be like, well, probably should have done something, you know,
thinking in my head like, yes, I know that I'm, well, I would like to think that I'm a good person. And I think something that comes with that is growing when you have space to grow. And I think this is a really great space for white people, if you can recognize what the situation is calling for, what this moment is calling for, to grow and be a better person for the rest of your life. Like it is, you're changing mentalities for the rest of your life, basically.
I literally found last week a paper I wrote my freshman year of high school about the Black Lives Matter movement. And
oh my God.
And so I'm sitting here, I'm like, that's been like 8 years. That's a long ass time for things to not change. But because I've like been here throughout this growth, there is something so different about what has happened these past few months than has ever happened before. I mean, there was the initial outrage with Trayvon Martin's murder and then with Michael Brown's murder in Ferguson, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And to now, look, I don't want George Floyd to have died in vain. And yeah. I'm sorry that it took his brutal murder for people to wake the fuck up. But I'm also like, I am so glad that people are here. And the energy behind this movement now is not something I've seen over the past 5, 6, 7 years. If there has not been this sense of urgency before that was outside of like the Black community, you know, like this is a global issue. It's not just like Americans talking about an American issue. I mean, people from like all over the world are like, yo, this is messed up, this needs to change,
right?
I'm so glad. It's about freaking time.
Yeah,
you know, you say it's become a global issue, but even on the scale of like in America, the way that I've seen it a lot, and like this isn't the only thing that's fueling it, but I think that, I mean, it's a big part of what's happening in November. And I think that you see there's just so much hate going on in the world, and at least the way I've seen it is that if you can just add just like a little bit more like love into the universe, like it does a lot. And if you can add a little bit more respect for others, whether it's by doing little or big things, it can make a big difference. And I think at least I felt so scared about what's going to happen in November. And again, we don't know what's going to happen. It's a toss up for sure, as Taylor said. But I think that's been fueling a lot of my worries and realizing like there are a lot of people who do not see what like we've talked about. They don't see that and they don't understand it and they still are refusing to get it. And I think that's scary. And I don't think that's going to change based on who's elected in November. But I think knowing that there's this huge group of people in America who do not understand, that is a great reason to keep doing what we're doing.
And there's a huge piece of it exactly. too, right? Is like there are people who are silent but agree. Mm-hmm. And it yeah. is a matter of if they like show up, then we'll be like, it will be so different. Because like people are comfortable sitting in ignorance, and that's not something that like I can change no matter how loud I scream. But the people who are staying silent, even when they agree with like, this is an injustice and like, this needs to change, I think that's what's going to be the huge player in November is like, are they going to finally use their voice and not sit in complacency and not sit in silence?
I'm just thinking about what Allison was saying and almost like the need and like what Taylor, you were saying, like the need for like this galvanization of people that are not like, not just like us. I mean, like we're very loud people. We've known that for the entire time we've all known each other, but that was a big foundation of us becoming friends. But I think for me, using that loudness to like be like, I think I'm being almost like annoying to some people on Instagram talking about voting and getting like people that aren't really active or vocal about any which issue to like, at least see my very annoying stories. Like they're seeing it, so at least they're being exposed to like what's happening with voting and with their own specific voting rights. So like I could be shouting into like a silent room of people that are just staring back at me, which is what Instagram feels like a lot of the time, but like at least I'm screaming and I'm being heard. So it's like I think recognizing right now, like, what's the most I can do? It's like, I can't go out and vote for other people, but I can say like, hey, it's going to be a little difficult for you to vote from home if you're trying to stay safe during, you know, a global pandemic this year. So here's some ways to get started right now. So it's easy. And like, or like, just like stuff like that. And if like one or two more people hears it than before I started talking about it, then that's successful for me, I think.
I don't repost just to like put things out into the abyss. I repost because like I read it, I found it interesting, or if it's tested through voting or BLM or whatnot. And if I can change one person's opinion, then it's all worth it. I quite frankly, it's the same thing. I don't care if I annoy people. If you're annoyed by freaking Black Lives Matter posts, then maybe you need to check yourself. But it's like, if you can change one person's opinion, or you can get one more person to vote a little bit earlier, then we've done our job.
But by being able to tell people to vote, I think that is one of the best possible ways to right now express your support for everything that's going on. And I say that because I think that people are receptive to voting, and I think people our age are, and I think that people get lazy and they say, oh, I forgot to send in my absentee ballot or whatever. It's not that they're saying, oh, I won't vote. You know what I mean? So like, even to a Trump supporter, like, they're going to vote. Like, you know, they're going to vote. So the fact that people, no matter what party you're from, a party support, they're going to vote. And so in that way, it's like a very non-controversial thing to post. So even if you're being like, so you said annoying because you posted like 8 things about how like your absentee ballot or whatever didn't come in time, it's important. And I think it's a good way to show allyship right now, even though it's not so direct. But because it's not so direct, that's like a way to make change.
I mean, literally, barely 100 years ago, we as women could not vote.
Exactly.
And those women fought so hard for us to use our voice. And the same thing goes for Black folk. Not even 100 years ago, not even 50 years ago, we could not vote. And the fact that we have the right to vote as women is huge, and we need to do that.
You know, for me, it's not, a lot of people say, oh, I would never be friends with a Trump supporter. Honestly, for me, I can honestly say that's not it for me. For me, I will not be friends with someone who doesn't vote. That is the end all be all for me.
Oh my gosh, I know.
It's not about who you vote for. I don't, obviously, like, I'm voting for Biden. I'll say that here loud and proud, but I don't think that anyone voting for Trump is making a good decision in any way, shape, or form, but I do respect people with different political views as long as they vote. And you not voting, you are the biggest problem of them all. You're bigger than the voices, bigger problem than the voices that are conflicting with mine or the Democratic Party, whatever. Like, not voting is essentially like the worst thing you could do right now.
I think it goes back to what Blair was saying before about, at least if you make a comment, like a bold comment, like have like a substantiated reason behind what you're saying. Like, if you're, everyone knows where I stand on Trump. I wrote my honors thesis on his mentor, trying to understand this man. We all know this about me. Sorry if maybe it's not public knowledge to people listening to the podcast, but I have a particular stance on Trump, but I at least can talk to Trump supporters and try to understand why they're so willing to support him, because they have a reason why they're willing to support him. People that are just like, I guess I'll vote, or I don't know who I'm going to vote for, so I won't vote. Like, who are you then? Like, it's not like, not who you vote for doesn't define who you are, but like, if you don't have values enough to side with something and to take a stand on something the way that voting is taking a stand, like, then who are you?
Well, also, not to be like inflammatory here, but there's a reason that it's the Republican Party that often is on the edge of voter suppression. And I have a very strong belief that, like, if you are running for president, you should be trying to do what's best for the country, right? That's your role, is you're going out to be the president of the United States. You right? It seems logical. So then why are people, if a candidate is going out there trying to suppress people from voting and making all these rules, doesn't it tell you something about the way that they see this country? It's not about going to be president because they genuinely think they can do the best thing. It's that if a bunch of people can't vote, they'll be able to win. And that fuels something in them, some secret agenda.
I think building off of your point, like, what does it say about a candidate if you can't win unless you shut other voices out of the vote? Like, what does it say about you if you can't win unless, like, some voices are not heard during the election? Or what does it say if you didn't win the popular vote, if the majority of the people you are representing don't support you? I mean, I've got beef with the Electoral College for that reason.
Yeah, that's on democracy. I have one last question for you all to like conclude. If you could, each of you, please share one resource or anything like that that you have found really helpful during this time in your road to becoming an incredible white ally.
I say this in the most general way possible. Instagram has actually been really helpful for me. It's just you can find groups of people that are Black themselves or allies that post really useful content. I find a lot of those like slideshows of like slides of like defining things. I think in terms of like movies or books, Just Mercy, amazing book. I have a long list of books that I'm getting through, but that's the first one I finished. And then that film is amazing. 13th is great. And then I also watched Fruitvale Station. I think any movies like that, that just, I don't think you need to corner yourself into like, you have to watch this specific movie, but I think any movie that's showing discrimination or Black men being unlawfully killed, if that doesn't give someone a wake-up call, I don't know what will.
You know, for me, I think that it's been less about what to consume and more about what I do or what you do once you do consume it. So it's not just saying, okay, like I've read, you know, Claudia Rankine's Citizen. I've read, you know, The Whole Power Broker, which has a ton to do with underlying racial relations because Robert Moses is who Robert Moses was. But whatever book that I've read that's educated me in some way on all this stuff, I've read it, but then what did I do with it? I just read it and I educated myself, which is great. And that's been an awesome start. But then now I've kind of gone back into what I've read before and looking to other things. Like I read and I saw Just Mercy, like Blair mentioned, which was great and definitely recommend. But you know, not just watching Just Mercy by myself, but saying, hey, mom and dad, why don't we all sit down together and watch this movie that I think would be important to watch and then discuss it afterwards. Just by doing stuff like that and actually, you know, absorb, you know, taking in this information, but then having a conversation about it afterwards, something like that makes the extra difference, I think. And I think that this is great that people are, you know, these Amazon books are selling out on Amazon, whatever they are. And these great books, and everyone should be reading them. But I think it's not just about reading, it's about what you're going to do after that.
I would say bookshop.org has truly been my greatest resource right now, because, I mean, we've touched on it in so many different ways in this conversation, but kind of thinking about the longevity of allyship and the kind of ups and downs and like the ways in which we need to integrate being an ally into our lives. Like books are such a fundamental part of my life. Just a big reader. I'm from a family of big readers. I want to be with books like in my career and stuff. But I think with Bookshop, the thing that's been really great is A, it provides money to independent bookstores that have been largely affected by COVID, but B, it offers you a lot of lists. And so the thing that it's done for me is, yes, like there's a lot of really great educational books, like of Just Mercy is amazing. The movie as well. The thing that I've noticed that I've kind of benefited from Bookshop specifically is integrating Black fiction, like fiction written by Black authors into my quarantine reading list has been, it feels kind of insignificant when you say it out loud or when you think about it. But then when I look at all the books that I've read so far, in quarantine, the things that I've learned from not just like out and out educational books, but from reading narrative stories from Black voices has been so impactful and so fitting for my life. And so it makes the allyship that I'm trying to embody in my spaces, in my life, it just makes sense. So I really, really recommend Bookshop to everyone. If you are going to buy a book right now or books right now, definitely buy it through Bookshop.
Thank you so much to each of you. I am so grateful to be friends with you and to have all of you in my life. Thank you to the listener for tuning in and walking with us on this journey. You can learn more about the project at grayskullmovement.org, and that's gray with an A, and check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter while you're at it. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.